strengthen further before making landfall.
Storm warnings extend from Belize along the entire eastern side of the Yucatan Peninsula. In addition to hurricane force winds, Rena is forecast to dump 16 inches of rain and flood coastal areas with a 5 to 7 foot storm surge. Rena is on track to pummel a stretch of shoreline that's home to some of Mexico's most popular beach resorts. Hotels on the island of Cozumel are shutting down and moving guests to the mainland. Cruise ships have been diverted away from the area. Authorities have evacuated some fishing villages, but even in inland areas, they're warning residents to take extreme precautions. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
A coroner in London has ruled that singer Amy Winehouse died from drinking too much alcohol. Cause of death, alcohol poisoning. Winehouse had fought drug and alcohol problems for years. She was found dead in her London home in July at the age of 27. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the early years of the 20th century, large numbers of African Americans began to leave the South. It came to be called the Great Migration. Isabel Wilkerson, our guest for this hour, says that vast as this movement of people was, this was really not just about numbers. It was also about the lasting effects of so many people uprooting themselves and transporting their culture to the big cities of the North and the West. She says they brought the music and folkways of the South with them, creating a hybrid that has become woven into American life, politics, and popular culture. In this hour of the show, we will talk with Isabel Wilkerson about her award-winning book, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. It was first published in hardcover last year and has just now come out in paperback. It's published by Vintage. So if you have not read the book, here is your opportunity to read it. And it's a great, great story. Just a couple of quick things about our guest, and then we'll get with her. Isabel Wilkerson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. She won the Pulitzer for feature writing for her work as the Chicago Bureau Chief of New York Times. That was in 1994. Currently, she is professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University, and she's joining us by phone. As we talk, as always, questions welcome. We just ask people to be brief, but questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you may also do that. It's the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Ms. Wilkerson, hello.
Hello. Great to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I know that you have worked very hard to personalize this story, and we'll talk about that. And I know that you want to go beyond the demographics, but I think one has to begin by acknowledging what a tremendous event, just in terms of demographics, this was and how it changed the population of the country. It's just, you know, stunning when you think about how, as you write in the book, before this began, something like 90% of all African Americans lived in the South. And by the end of this time, that had changed very, very significantly.
You're absolutely right. When this migration began, there were fewer than 10 million African Americans in the country overall, and 90% of them were limited, restricted, or isolated in the South. And by the end of it, 6 million of them had left, and it redistributed this entire population such that by the end of it, half of all African Americans were living outside of the South, from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Something else, I think you make a number of really interesting points, and there are ways in which I think you look at this story differently than historians, demographers, people have looked at it in the past. And what seems to be the case is that for others who other scholars who have looked at this, they pretty much looked at this as an issue of internal migration. That is, people moving from one part of the country to another part of the country. And you make this really interesting argument that for these people, this was really more like moving from one country to another country. And in one reviewer, I think, put it really well, where he wrote that the folks who were a part of this migration were more like refugees than migrants.
Yes, in fact, I view it as, first of all, one of the great underreported stories of the 20th century, partly because the people didn't talk about it. They didn't tell their own children and grandchildren about what they'd endured. It also was, in some ways, an unrecognized immigration within the borders of our own country, because this is the first time that, and really the only time in our history, when American citizens had to or felt they had to leave their region of birth for other parts of their own country just to be recognized as the citizens to which they had been born. That's because they were in some ways defecting a caste system which is almost unimaginable to us today, a caste system in which it was actually against the law for a black person and a white person to merely play checkers together in Birmingham, and where in courtrooms throughout the South there was, believe it or not, a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on. They could not touch the same sacred object if they were about to take the witness stand. And that's a world that's almost hard for us to imagine, but that was the world that they were fleeing from, almost seeking political asylum within the borders of their own country, but in parts of the country that they felt were safer.
Yeah. This, I think, is another really important point, that as people have, scholars have looked at this movement, this migration, and have tried to answer the question, why, what was the motivation? It seems as if the standard explanation was economic, which was sort of tied to the environment in the sense that people said, well, cotton was the big crop, cotton and tobacco, and that they were kind of played out, cotton particularly, and that people just, they moved because they couldn't make a living farming the way that they had. And again, you're making a really different argument that says, now that's really not the thing that motivated people, that in a sense their motivation was not so much economic as it was, I don't know if political is the right word to use, but that's the first one that comes to me.
Well, I think that's a great point that you make. I mean, first of all, you know, there's not one South, but multiple Souths. And so cotton alone couldn't account for the departure of the 6 million, because there are parts of the South where cotton was not grown at all. There are parts of, you know, North Carolina and Virginia, for example, which had huge out-migrations to Philadelphia and to New York, for example, where tobacco was the primary crop. There were other parts of, say, Florida, where citrus was the main crop. But all of these states had a tremendous outflow of people. They left from all of these states, from Texas to Virginia, and they all left. Ultimately, what tied them all together was that they were all living under a caste system, which we often call Jim Crow, which was brutally enforced. It was an artificial hierarchy that was enforced to such a degree that every 4 days an African-American was lynched for some perceived breach of this caste system in the decades leading up to the migration and the decade after the migration, because that was the world in which they were leaving. And so it was more encompassing than that. And in fact, when the people are interviewed, you know, I interviewed over 1,200 people over the course of the years that I worked on this book. And the primary thing, once they began to talk, and many of them didn't want to talk at first because it was so painful for them, was that they were seeking freedom like anyone else would be under the world in which they were living. They wanted to be free for all that that meant. Economics certainly did have a part, because, for one thing, many of them were not being paid for their hard work. Many of them were working for the right to live on the land that they were farming. They were sharecroppers and not being paid at all. The idea of being able to, of working hard and then getting paid for it, was clearly something that was a part of the goal that they had for themselves. I mean, how can you move up if you're not being paid? So it's all bound up in one, and they would, in their words, they would describe it as a search for freedom.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Isabel Wilkerson. She's a professor of journalism, director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University, was for a number of years a reporter for the New York Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize, in fact, for feature writing for her work as the Chicago bureau chief of the New York Times. That was 1994. And she is the author of the book The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. It is just out in paperback. It's published by Vintage. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You're connected to this migration because your parents were part of it. But I'm, again, really struck by the thing that you say about how people really didn't talk about it. They didn't talk a lot about what their life in the South had been like. And I know that you went around looking for people willing to talk about it, and you went to places where people had gathered. And I know that you said something like, well, if you started out at saying, how many, can I have a show of hands, how many people here were part of the Great Migration? Well, nobody would put their hands up. But then if you said, okay, how many of you moved, say, from the South to Los Angeles between this time and this time? Well, everybody put their hand up. So clearly they were part of something here, but there was some reluctance to identify with that.
Well, it's interesting that you're absolutely right. The migration, just to clarify, began during World War I and didn't end until the 1970s. So you're talking of a large span of time, much of the 20th century, when it came to the cities as we know them, what was going on in the South, and certainly when it comes to African Americans and their decision making, was that part of our history and of the 20th century was about migration out of the South. And when these people are asked about it, they will often, they don't identify themselves as part of the Great Migration, which is one of the goals of the book, was to help us to, in some ways, restore this part of our history to its rightful place so that we can all appreciate the impact that it had on all of us as Americans. But it's interesting to note that their goal, I mean, their idea of leaving was often a personal and individual decision. And it might have been the first big decision that they had to make. And one thing that's different about this from anything that we might be doing today, it's not the same as relocating from Cincinnati to Denver. These people were ultimately leaving the only places that they'd ever known for a place that they'd never seen. Many of them had never been outside of the rural county in Mississippi into which they had been born. They were jumping off a cliff into the unknown to get to a place called Chicago or Cleveland or Detroit or Los Angeles or wherever these places might have been. And they were arriving to big, teeming, anonymous cities where they had to find a way to make a way for themselves. This was a complete break from all that they had known, and that's the reason why I compare it to an immigrant experience. In some ways, these people are proxies for what someone in all of our backgrounds had to have done just for us to be here.
Yeah, there was certainly one of the things about this was that in these people's minds, there was no expectation, no idea that when they moved, if things didn't work out, they could go back. There was not going to be any going back.
No, there was no going back. It was a complete break, and they couldn't bear the thought. I mean, for any immigrant, failure is not an option. I mean, there's no place to return to. They've made this decision to leave. Many of them, it's not. Many people don't realize. I hadn't realized how dangerous it was for some of them to leave. I mean, the South made it very difficult for them to leave, particularly in the beginning. They would arrest people from the railroad platforms. Many of them had to plan and strategize without telling anyone because many of the plantations had spies that were hired or paid for by the planters to alert them to any sharecropper or anyone who was planning to leave. So it was a difficult and very dangerous time in which to try to leave. Many of them had to, in some ways, flee for their lives in a way that's hard for us to imagine today. So when you mentioned my own family background, my own parents did not talk with me about this. They never talked about their experience as part of a Great Migration. I did not grow up with this as part of any kind of household or family discussion. And I knew where they'd come from, but I didn't know the particulars, how or why they made the decision. It's just something that they had done, and no one talked about it.
And it seems pretty clear that also part of your motivation in writing the book was to get some of these stories, because it seemed that you were really sensitive to the fact that these people were getting on in years. And in fact, I think the principal people, the three principal people that you profile in the book, have all passed. So I'm sure that's something that you were thinking about.
Yes, I actually went about it with a great sense of urgency because I knew that, you know, obviously it began during World War One, and it did continue on into 1970, but the people were getting up in years, so it was kind of a race against the clock to get to them before it was too late. Many of those people that I, you know, interviewed are not with us anymore. It's a generation that is passing away, and I wanted to get the stories before it was too late. You know, it's one of the goals I would hope that anyone, wherever, whatever our background might be, would, you know, have a sense of gratitude and appreciation for the sacrifices someone had to make for us to be here. I mean, whether your family came from, you had a great-grandmother from Ireland or from Germany or from China, wherever they might have come from, because somebody had to do what the people in this book did, and part of this, what the people in this migration did, just for us to be here, sort of to help us appreciate what's gone before us.
Yeah. This is just to come back to the point you made, and I really want people to think about it, the fact that, you know, say today, if you lived in Atlanta and you decided you wanted to move to Chicago, no one's going to tell you that you couldn't. But that these people literally had to plan this in secret. Some people sneaked away in the middle of the night because it was the decision to go was extremely dangerous.
The decision to go was extremely dangerous, could mean your life, and that was because the South did not take kindly to this defection of their cheap labor. I mean, the crops that they depended upon that we've mentioned, you know, cotton, tobacco, rice, sugarcane are extremely labor intensive, and the entire economy of the South depended upon having not just a supply of cheap labor, but an oversupply of cheap labor that would be at the ready whenever it was necessary for these crops to be planted and ultimately harvested. And so the idea of this mass departure of millions of their cheap labor was a great threat to the South, and they did what they could to keep them from leaving. Their efforts to keep them from leaving only fed the desire to go, because it indicated to many of them that things were not going to change for them as individuals unless they left. And so it was an interesting paradox of the South's effort to keep them from leaving. But it was quite dangerous, and the goal is to of the way that I approach the book and of the stories of three individuals who represent the 6 million is to have the reader ask him or herself, what would I have done? What would I have done had I been in the situation that these people were in? Would I have gone, or would I have stayed, you know, and how would I have managed to make that decision, and how would I have made a way for myself in these big cities and big places and alien places in the rest of the country? So that's what it asks, and that's what I hope people will consider as they think about this.
Were there people in the South, white people in the South, who looked at what was going on and rather than saying we should use whatever means we can to keep these people here and keep them here by force if that's what we have to do. And people who said rather, well, you know, maybe we should look at, you know, look to our own houses and look to this society that we live in. And maybe if people would, maybe if black people felt that this they were disadvantaged and it was a bad situation, well, maybe we should change things. Did anybody ask that question?
There was a great deal of debate and hand-wringing among the the opinion makers and decision makers of the South as to what to do. They considered and thought about all kinds of things. Some of them were hopeful, actually, that maybe what they viewed as the rabble-rousers, the people who would be the ones who'd be trying to lead revolts would be the ones to leave, and they would just as soon have them go. There were others who were wringing their hands because they actually had no one to plow the fields for them on some mornings. I mean, there are many, many examples of people who literally were left in the lurch as a result of the fact that people were leaving. And then there were those who, there was the one planter who said that his decision was he figured out a way to keep them from going. He was going to put away his whip and his gun, and he thought that if he did that, these people would stay. Now, we're not talking about slavery. None of the things in this book have anything to do with slavery. We're talking 20th century and the lifespan of many people who are alive today. And the fact that this planter felt that if he put aside his whip and gun, perhaps they would stay. It's first an indication he was using a whip and gun on, you know, fully adult, you know, American citizens who were working for him, but that he actually believed that that would make a difference. Somehow they would trust him more if he promised to put it away, which gives an indication of how harsh the conditions were for the people.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone who is listening in Indiana. So let's do that on our toll-free line. Line four. Hello.
Hello. I'm very glad you did this one, David, because this is an eye-opener if there ever was one. Question I have that sort of deals with the cultural effect of the immigration. We all know about, you know, for example, Louis Armstrong going to Chicago and sort of changing jazz. I was wondering more along the lines of the painters, the poets, and the people who wrote novels, for example. They probably must have found areas where they were actually allowed to show their work and perhaps get it published. And I was wondering how that worked itself out. Thank you.
Okay.
That is such a great question. That's such a great question. You know, one of the things that is so inspiring and moving to me about this whole migration is that it was the first time in American history, in our country's history, when the people who were lowest down in the caste system were, after all these centuries, the first time that anyone in their group had in large numbers the opportunity to truly live out their God-given talents. And so once the people made it to the North, their children had a chance to be things and dream of being people that they never could have dreamt of before if they'd been out in the field. And those people include such, you know, individuals such as Toni Morrison, who would never have been able to have truly become the novelist that she did had her parents stayed in Alabama. For one reason, it was against the law for African Americans to go into a library and take out a library book. And, you know, if you're going to become a Nobel laureate, you kind of need to get a book now and then. And their moving to Ohio ensured that their daughter would get a chance to get exposure and get a better education, which would have led to her ability to become the novelist and also get exposure to the talent that was within her all along. When you think of theater, you think of August Wilson, who would never even have existed had there been no Great Migration, which is also a very American story of all the people who wouldn't have existed had there not been these different migration streams from parts of Europe to the United States or parts of the South to other parts of the North. And August Wilson, his mother migrated from North Carolina, where she met a man in Pittsburgh. He grew up to become a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. Every single one of his plays was an examination of the effect of this migration ultimately. In other words, what was gained, what was lost, who owned the culture of the South, and who had made the better decision, and the cultural impact and psychological impact of the dislocation of a people from one part of the country to another. That's, if you think about all of his plays, that's what they were about. And then you think of A Raisin in the Sun, which is about a family that had migrated from Mississippi to Chicago. The head of the household dies, and then the family is left with a decision as to what shall they do now that they have a decision to make. And then you think about music overall, and beyond Louis Armstrong, you also think about someone such as Miles Davis, whose parents were in Arkansas, and they made the migration to Southern Illinois. And, you know, had they not done that, their son would not have had the luxury of the hours upon hours upon hours that it would have taken for him to be able to perfect what was already this, you know, God-given talent within him, but to be able to have it flourish and to become the musician that he did, the legend that he did. And then you think about Thelonious Monk, whose parents migrated from North Carolina to Harlem, and he too got the luxury to be able to practice music in a way that he never would have in the tobacco country of North Carolina. And then John Coltrane, who migrated himself at the age of 16 from North Carolina to Philadelphia, where, believe it or not, it was there in Philadelphia that he got his first alto sax. And you combine all of these people, and this is just the tip of the iceberg of people who were the first in American history, the first generation of African Americans to truly be able to live out their God-given talents. You know, you think, where would jazz be, for example, had these individuals, those three that I mentioned, not gotten the chance to live out their, you know, the genius that was within them all along? Where would music be? And not just for the United States, but for the world. These people that I've mentioned are as revered in Tokyo and Paris as they are in the United States. So these are in some ways gifts to the world.
Yeah. I think that's, again, one of the other important points about this story that you make is that while the lives of people, well, like your parents, changed tremendously, that is, because they moved, they had a much different life than they would have had they stayed. Maybe the bigger change for the country were the changes that came about because of the children of the Great Migration, people like you and people of your generation and some of the kind of people that you talk about, you have just talked about.
I think so. I think that that's one of the cultural impact of this migration is the fact that you had the first wave of people who had not been able to live out fulfill their abilities. And you think about, the loss of the country overall, it becomes an unanswerable question, but you think about how all of these people are descended from individuals who had not been able to live out their dreams. They were stuck in the field somewhere. I mean, you think about John Coltrane, was he even the most talented person in his family? I mean, we will never know because his grandparents and great-grandparents never had the opportunity. But the impact of the migration went beyond just the actual individuals I've mentioned. The civil rights movement that ultimately freed the South of the great burden of this caste system forced the South to free itself, you might say, really came about because of it was preceded by this tremendous outflow of people that put so much pressure north and south that it forced the entire country to deal with something that it had never really dealt with before, and that was this dual system that was operating in the South that was untenable, could not go on forever, and the civil rights movement would have occurred eventually, but it certainly was hastened by this outflow of six million people of the workers of the South. The cheap labor of the South had a tremendous impact north and south, and it helped to accelerate the drive toward ultimately human rights and freedom for that group, but also extending to everyone, because this has been a smirch on the entire country. How can you point to the human rights abuses in other countries when you have a caste system existing within the borders of your own? And that was always a conundrum for the United States. And finally, that was dealt with partly because of the decisions of all of these people to spread themselves out throughout the country and force the entire country to face something that it had not been dealing with
here,
all that time.
You really touch on something here. I'm glad we got to this point. I was kind of saving a question that I had here from somebody who was listening and sent it in as an email, who raised the issue of making a reference to the conflict, particularly around issues of civil rights that we saw in this country in the 50s and the 60s, and raising the question, well, was this movement really so good for African Americans? And particularly there is the question about whether or not the kinds of changes that did finally come about might have happened sooner if more people had stayed in the South. It sounds as if you would say no, in fact, that it would have happened, but it might well have taken longer.
I think it would have taken longer. I think when you look at the circumstances of the people in the South at that time and the fact that they were so isolated and they had no options for another way of living, there was no competition. There were too many people concentrated in one area, which meant that their work was devalued and their lives were devalued. And by spreading themselves out throughout the country, it forced other parts of the country to take notice of what was going on in the South and in fact intervene. And the reason is, if you think about it, whenever the United States gets involved in any conflict throughout the world, it's often because there's a large number or percentage of people here in this country from that part of the world. When you think about the changes that occurred in Northern Ireland, for example, there's a very large Irish-American population here, and thus that means that it's on the radar screen in a way that it might not otherwise be. And the same goes for the existence, just the mere presence of African-Americans in large numbers in such powerful places as, Chicago or Illinois, in New York, in Washington, D.C., which these are the cities that the people went to, that forced those places, which were centers of media, to take notice of what was going on in the South. There had been efforts to fight the caste system, efforts to seek freedom within the strictures of that of the South for generations. I mean, for generations there have been uprisings and efforts to free themselves, but they were like trees that were falling and no one to hear them. Suddenly, when there were large numbers of African Americans in these big cities where there's great, you know, media and attention and power and influence in the Congress, the cameras then went down to the South and began to record what had been going on for all that time. And then that those images went out to the world, and it forced the country to deal with something that it had not been dealing with before. The mere presence of so many African Americans in the North had several effects. One of them is it exposed those who decided to stay and fight, and it exposed them to how life could be if the South were to change. They could go to the North and they could see that people could, you know, ride anywhere on the streetcar that they wanted, that they could get jobs and actually get a paycheck instead of getting scrip or getting further in debt to the planter. And they could see how life was for their cousins or their big brothers or sisters or aunts or uncles or whoever it might have been who they knew up in the North now. And they had to ask themselves, why can't we have that where we are from? And so that helped to feed this, you know, the exposure to what was possible helped to feed what we now view as a civil rights movement.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Isabel Wilkerson. We're talking about her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. We'll talk more in just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have something different every day. In fact, two different things every day. In the second hour today, Celeste Gwynn will be hosting the show, and her guest will be Janice Harrington. She is an award-winning poet and author of children's books. Her work as a nurse's aide was the inspiration for her new book of poetry, The Hands of Strangers, Poems from the Nursing Home, and they'll be talking about that today in hour number two. Tomorrow morning, in the first hour of the show, the 10 o'clock hour, I will talk with Mark Spong. He is dean of the Eric Johnson School of Engineering and Computer Science at the University of Texas at Dallas, and we'll be talking about robots, something about the history of building these things, their applications, where the field is going. He's going to be on the campus to give a talk, and will talk with us tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and you can look at the schedule by going to our website. You can also listen to past programs that way, and that is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of focus, our guest is Isabel Wilkerson. She is a professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University, was for a number of years reporter for the New York Times. She, in fact, won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing for her work as the Chicago bureau chief of the Times in 1994. She's the author of the book The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. The book won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction, first was published in hardcover last year, and has just come out in paperback. It's published by Vintage. And questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to email your question, you can do that too. will-talk@illinois.edu. Back to some callers here, and we'll talk next with someone in Urbana. This is the callers here on line number one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Hi, Isabel. Thank you so much for your book. I'm excited to read it, and it's very needed. I'm from South Carolina, and I am white, and I now live in Illinois. And I moved to Illinois in 91 to come to graduate school. But growing up in the South, I never felt like I could fit in, and I still feel like when I travel down there to see family that it's still very much a hard place for me to go. And because I still feel this kind of spirit of racism and classism, and there's other really kind of bad isms, and that's a lot of my own baggage too. My family, say my grandparents, for instance, had African-American workers, but they were paid, maids, let's say, and yard workers. They were paid, but I don't know how much they were paid. My grandmother treated them with respect overall. My grandfather wasn't very nice, but he was kind of not really around that much. But anyway, to just get to the point is that I feel like I, as a white person, had to immigrate out of the South. And but I appreciate your book, and I just wanted to call and thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. I know, Ms. Wilkerson, how you might want to react to what the caller had to say.
Well, thank you so much. The book is actually done quite well in the South for the reasons that the caller expressed, and that is because, in a way, it's an opportunity to confront a system and a world that, in some ways, didn't go away overnight. There's still remnants, clearly. You can change the laws, but it may take longer to change the hearts of many people. And it's not as if by changing the law that you obliterate all that happened before the laws were changed. And so we're still living with the after effects of that caste system. And I'm heartened by the fact that it's done as well as it has in parts of the South. And interestingly enough, the book is about three individuals who made this journey. Each one of them left a different part of the South during a different decade, following the three different migration streams. And one of those streams is the one that carried people from Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, up to Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York. The second stream was the one that carried people basically up the Illinois Central City of New Orleans tracks from Mississippi and Arkansas and Tennessee, Alabama to Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, the entire Midwest. And I know many of them stopped off in Cairo and in Urbana and Champaign and Joliet all the way up. Then there was the migration stream that carried people from Louisiana and Texas out to California and the entire West Coast. Interestingly enough, to get to the caller's point, is that I actually have been invited since the book came out to the places where these three individuals that I wrote about were from. And in one place in particular, it's an opportunity to confront what had not been talked about on any side. I mean, no one really was talking about it, and it's an opportunity to heal because the wounds are there, but they don't go away just because we don't talk about them. And it's an opportunity because the book is written, and the approach that I take, and I hope you can gather it from the way I've talked about it, is that this is a universal human story. And essentially the question is, what would you have done had you been in the circumstances of the people who embarked upon this great migration? And when you think about that from that perspective, it's a portal for anyone to be able to imagine themselves in that world without judging, without shame, without guilt, but just approaching it as a human being, one to another. And that's the goal. And these three people that I've written about, they are beautifully imperfect human beings who made the decision of their lives and were part of this great wave of people who, you know, changed the country north and south just by a single decision. And it's inspiring to know that a single decision can have this much impact.
Yeah. Well, again, I want to thank the caller very much and hope she will not mind if I go on to another. This is also someone in Urbana, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hello, good morning. This is a wonderful conversation. I had two questions, sort of questions, comments. One is that, isn't it true that during World War I, when all of the white American men were being, you know, shipped overseas to fight in the war, many of the northern industries had to go south and recruit workers to come north? So at least in that early stage, those early stages of the migration, it wasn't just people picking up and leaving. I mean, I'm sure they left because of the conditions in the South, but part of it also had to do with they were being called to work in the North. And, of course, I mean, I know it's more complicated than that, but I just wanted to comment on that. And the other comment or question I had was about those who chose not to migrate. Isn't it true that some family members, you know, not everyone ran away from slavery, not everyone wanted to run away during the migration, but didn't they have a fear of suffering the consequences? If the white person couldn't get a hold of the man who ran away, he might go after his relatives in the South who stayed.
Yes, actually, to answer your second question first, one of the reasons that people were very cautious about how they left was because they were fearful about reprisals against other family members. And many of them, when they left, in the same way that might have occurred in an immigration experience or kind of like a Harriet Tubman situation, they would try to get as many of their family members out as they could. So it was in some ways like a relocation of people who were seeking political asylum within the borders of their own country, which is almost hard for us to imagine now, but that was the world in which they lived.
Right.
As to your first question, the migration did not begin until World War I, as you state. It began in World War I because during World War I, Europe was at war, and the foundries and the factories and the steel mills and the railroads of the North had a labor shortage, and they began to look for the cheapest labor in the land, which was African Americans in the South. And so the very first wave of African Americans who came at the express invitation of people in the North. However, the conditions of the circumstances under which they were living were so harsh that they had actually been wanting to leave for many, many generations. I mean, life was so untenable. And if you think about the decades leading up to World War I, that was a time when the South began tightening the vise on African Americans in a way that was so disheartening for them. That was when these laws of segregation, Jim Crow, starting with Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, that is when it began to become especially untenable for those who had any ambitions for themselves whatsoever. But they had no way to get out. They had nothing that they could be assured of as a way to be able to make a way for themselves anywhere outside of the South. They had no connections to anyone in the North, and they had no way of thinking that they could make a way for themselves in the North. It was because of World War I, when the North began to recruit people from the South, that they suddenly finally had a way out, finally had a connection. But when the North began to recruit them, the South didn't take kindly to this recruitment at all, and they did everything they could to keep the people from leaving. They would arrest them from the railroad platforms. They would arrest them from their train seats. They would wave the train on through when there were too many African Americans seeking to, you know, head north. So they made it really difficult for the people to leave. And in an odd kind of way, they actually began to bear down even harder on them. During this period of time that I'm describing, every 4 days, an African-American was lynched for some perceived breach of the caste system that I've described. So these were life and death decisions on the part of many people to escape a world that's hard for us to even imagine today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to reading your book.
All right, well,
thank you.
Here's another email comment I think is interesting. Someone who was listening to and agreeing with your point about how music, jazz particularly, was influenced by this, and it became important all around the world. The person just goes on to write, it wasn't just London and Paris that were changed by jazz. Maybe you might also mention that African-American music also actually traveled back to Africa, and that the sound of jazz and the sight of black people playing it was very important in Southern African culture, and particularly in places like South Africa and Zimbabwe.
I would add that jazz is just one iteration of music that was affected by this. I mean, the people, when they left, they brought with them the folk ways, the food, the ways of speaking, and the music, which would have been spirituals, the blues, and gospel music. They brought that with them. They didn't have very much else to bring, but that's one of the things that they brought. And then their children reinterpreted that into many, many art forms that we now take for granted. I mean, jazz is one of them, but rhythm and blues, and blues led to, helped inspire rock and roll as we know it. Many of the British rock and roll artists
attribute much of their inspiration to the blues musicians who they came to know of as a result of the Great Migration, and then even hip hop as we know it today. Many of the people who the big names in hip hop or today's music are now the grandchildren of the migration. So it continues even to this day. Mm. And this music is not just American music; it's music for the world, because you can hear this anywhere in the world that you go. It's become one of the great imports of American culture, and it is a result of this great migration.
So you talked about there being these three streams, one that went up the East Coast, one that went from Louisiana, Texas, out to the West Coast, and then one that came up the central part of the United States. So we had people from, say, Arkansas and Mississippi relocating to big cities in the upper Midwest, like Chicago and Detroit and
yeah,
Cleveland. And that, as you explained, I made reference to, you're trying to personalize the story, because you're talking about millions of people. It's kind of hard to get a grip on that, so that you picked three individuals, each from one of these three different streams. So we're now coming down to have about 5 minutes left, but maybe I would ask you to talk, since we are here in we're in the central stream, you might say a couple things about Ida Mae Gladney.
Yes, I'm happy to do that. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney was the wife of a sharecropper in Chickasaw County, Mississippi. She had never been outside of the rural county into which she had been born, and she had the misfortune of having been terrible at picking cotton. You know, you don't think about people being good or bad at it. That's just what they had to do, and it turned out that she was really bad at it. She could not pick 100 pounds of cotton, no matter how hard she tried, and that was considered the standard, the minimum of what you'd be expected to pick. To give an idea of how much work that was, it was the equivalent of picking 7,000 cotton balls. It would have taken 7,000 bowls to make 100 pounds of cotton. That's a lot of picking, and you would have had to have done that every day during the picking season in order to meet the expected quota for the time that she was working. So she was very bad at it. But it turned out that the family ended up leaving. Not for that reason. They left because a relative of her husband's had been beaten to within an inch of his life over a theft that he had not committed. The thing that they thought he had stolen turned up the next day. But in the world in which they were living, this is 1930s, Chickasaw County, Mississippi, there were no apologies in order if something like that happened. And sometimes they get the wrong person. Sometimes a person might die. Sometimes they might have survived it. But it's just the way life was. But after that, her husband said to her, "This is the last crop we're making. This is the last crop we're making, and we're leaving." And what they ended up doing was they ended up not being able to tell anyone that they were about to leave, because they were sharecroppers. And they were tied to the land in the same way that, even though we're not talking slavery, but in the same way that slaves would have been tied to their plantation, because they remained in debt. And they didn't keep the books, and the books were never working in their favor, and so they were tied to the land. So they had to set about divesting of what little they had. They only confided in her mother and a trusted cousin of his, and they set about planning to leave. They had to, in some ways, flee. They caught the Illinois Central. Went up to Chicago, then on to New York, to Milwaukee, and then they ended up back in Chicago, ultimately settling in Chicago. And she lived out most of her life. She lived out more of her years in the North than in the South. But the interesting thing about her is that she remained a Southerner at heart. She found this way to sort of represent and embrace the best of both cultures. And for that reason, she ends up being maybe the most inspiring person in the book, because she has this way of surviving and looking at the world that with a sense of wonderment and gratitude, which we all could learn from.
Hmm. One of the things I want to make sure that I ask you about here, we have a couple minutes left, and to get your take on, is some of the reporting that we actually saw earlier in the year about significant numbers of African Americans who had been living in big cities in the Northeast and the Midwest deciding to move back or to move to the South, and that they were moving to places like Atlanta and Houston and Miami, in fact, now we talked about how maybe at the end of the period of the Great Migration, close to half of all African Americans lived in the North. Now, according to some recent census figures, more than half of African Americans now live in the South. And I wonder what your take on that. This, I don't know if it's enough to say this is a reverse migration, but it's significant numbers.
It is. It's being called that. But of course, the Great Migration ended in the 1970s, and no one disputes that. It was only after the changes that finally occurred in the South, after all of the protests, after this Great Migration drained the South of much of its cheap labor and forced the South to change and the North to pay attention, that the South became a more welcoming place for anyone to live in. And that's in some ways one of the legacies of the decisions of the people in the Great Migration to begin with. Many of the people who were part of this migration to the South are moving to the big cities because they are urban people. They're not moving to the same places that their families may have been from, the rural areas. They're moving to the cities. They are in some ways Southern at heart, because many of these people were raised by Southerners. So the South has a connection to them. I mean, they are, it's like reclaiming a part of their own culture. However, the numbers are not the same when you think of the massive redistribution of people that occurred in the Great Migration. It's been 40 years since the Great Migration, and we're now at 57% in the South and the balance in the rest of the North and the Midwest and the West. I don't foresee any time when it'll return to 90% in the South and 10% in the rest of the country. The African Americans that we're speaking of are acting like all other Americans. They now have choices to live anywhere in the country that they choose to. And like other Americans, many of them are moving to, more affordable places in other parts of the country, such as the Sun Belt. And that's one of the great legacies of this, the freedom to be able to make a decision to live wherever you choose. Hmm.
This book, The Warmth of Other Suns, for you, was an enormous project. Took 15 years. You talked to way more than 1,000 people.
Yeah.
So this is an enormous undertaking. And for anybody, this would be a huge project. But so forgive this question, but I'm sure people also say so. Now, having done that, is there some big thing that you would like to try to take on?
Well, at this point, I want as many people as possible to read this book. I really do. It's now out in paperback. I'm delighted that it is, because it means there will be more people who have a chance to read it. I actually have met people who have said that they were number 157 on the waiting list at their public library, and now they can go out and buy the book for themselves, and so I'm looking forward to that. In other words, you know, I spent so much time on this, and I think it's such a big moment and watershed moment in our history as Americans, all of us, that I want people to recognize the sacrifice that was made for us to have the freedoms that we have now, and in some ways to connect their story to the story of all of us, because all of us have someone in our backgrounds who did what the people in this book did just for us to be here. Whether they came across the Atlantic, the Pacific, or the Rio Grande, we wouldn't be here, or the Bering Sea, we wouldn't be here if someone hadn't done what the people in this book did. And I want people to feel that connection. Whatever I do next, and I haven't settled on that, will be in the same vein of helping us to all recognize that we have so much more in common than we've been led to believe.
Our guest, Isabel Wilkerson, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. She is currently professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University. She is the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction, was first published in hardcover last year, and has just come out in paperback. It is published by Vintage, is now out available in bookstores. And Ms. Wilkerson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We will take a break at this point, as we usually do. For the next hour, Celeste Quinn will be your host, and she'll be talking with Janice Harrington. She is an award-winning poet and author of children's books. Her work as a nurse's aide was the inspiration for her new book of poetry, The Hands of Strangers, Poems from the Nursing Home. She'll be here with Celeste in the next hour. So right now, we hope you'll stay tuned. We'll pause, as we usually do, so we can bring you some news from National Public Radio and also an update on the commodity markets.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go ahead and go right on out to the trading floors in Kansas City. December wheat is now trading at 718, down 15 and a half. The May at 740 and a quarter, down 15 and a half as well. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 621 and a quarter, down 15. March, 657 and three quarters, down 15. And May, 679 and a half, down 15 and a half. December corn, 638, down 12 and three quarters. March, 650 and a quarter, down 12. May, 656 and a quarter, down 11 and a half. July, 660 and a quarter, down 11. And September, 620 and a quarter, down 9 and a half. November soybeans are trading